Already he had initiated his first moves. He sensed that others had come to him, had freed the path of Omtos Felak wards and seals. Perhaps his worshippers remained, fanatics who had sought his release for generations, and even now awaited him beyond the barrow. The missing Finist would be his first priority. Much of his power had been stored within the seed, stripped from him and stored there by the Jaghut betrayers. It had not been carried far, and there was nothing that could prevent his recovering it. Omtos Felak no longer existed in the land above. He could feel its absence like an airless void. Nothing could oppose him now. Preparation. Wraith's withered, cracked face twisted into a savage grin, his lower tusks splitting desiccated skin. The powerful must gather other power, subjugate it to their own will, then direct it unerringly. His moves had already begun. He sloshed through the slush now covering the barrow's muddy floor. Before him rose the slanted wall that marked the tomb's barrier. Beyond the lime-streaked earth waited a world to be enslaved. Wraith gestured, and the barrier exploded outward. Bright sunlight flared in the clouds of steam rolling around him, and he felt waves of cold, ancient air sweeping past him. The Jaghut tyrant walked into the light. The great raven crone rode the hot streams of wind high above the Gedrobi hills. The burst of power that launched tons of earth and rocks 100 feet into the sky elicited a cackle from her. She dipped a wing, eyes on the white pillar of steam, and banked toward it. This, she laughed to herself, should prove interesting. A wash of air pounded down onto her. Shrieking her outrage, Crone twisted and slid along the shunting wind. Massive shadows flowed over her. Her anger was swept away on a surge of excitement. Head craning, she beat the air with her wings and climbed again. In matters such as these, a proper point of view was essential. Crone climbed higher still, then cocked her head and looked down. By the light of the sun, scales flashed iridescent from 5 ridged backs, but of the 5, 1 shone like fire. Sorcerous power bled in ripples from the web of their spread wings. The dragons sailed silent over the landscape, closing on the billowing dust cloud above the Jaghut tomb. Crone's black eyes fixed on the dragon that blazed red.
Silana!
She screamed, laughing.
Dragnipura ke tna draconiones! Ilainta! Ilainta!
The day of the Tista Andi had come. Wraith emerged into rich afternoon sunlight. Yellow-grassed hills rose in weathered humps in every direction but the one he faced. To the east, behind a thinning curtain of drifting dust, stretched an empty plain. The Jaghut tyrant grunted. Not so different, after all. He raised his arms, feeling wind slide along his cabled muscles. He drew a breath, tasting the life-rich air. He quested lightly with his power, and exulted in the waves of fear that answered it. Answers that came from the mindless life beneath his feet, or hiding in the grasses around him. But of higher life, higher concentrations of power, he sensed nothing. Wraith drove his senses down into the ground, seeking what dwelt there. Earth and bedrock, the sluggish molten darkness beneath, down, down to find the sleeping goddess. Young as far as the Jaghut tyrant was concerned.
"Shall I wake you?" he whispered. "Not yet, but I shall make you bleed."
His right hand closed into a fist. He speared the goddess with pain, driving a fissure through the bedrock, feeling the gush of her blood, enough to make her stir but not awaken. The line of hills to the north lifted skyward. Magma sprayed into the air amid a rising pillar of smoke, rock, and ash. The earth shuddered even as the sound of the eruption swept over Raist in a fierce, hot wind. The Jaghut tyrant smiled. He studied the shattered ridge and breathed the heavy, sulphurous air, then turned about and strode west toward the highest hill in that direction. His finest lay beyond it, perhaps 3 days' walk. He considered opening his warren, then decided to wait until he reached the hill's summit. From that vantage point, he could better judge the Finist's location. Halfway up the slope, he heard distant laughter. Raist stiffened just as the day darkened suddenly around him. On the sward before him, he saw five enormous shadows sweeping up the slope, then beyond the hill's summit. The sunlight returned. The Jaghut tyrant looked into the sky above him. Five dragons banked in perfect formation, their heads dipping to watch him as they glided back in his direction.
"Ist dir ein Elainter?"
he whispered in his Jaghut tongue. Four were black, barbed in silver along the wings and flying two to either side of the fifth dragon, this one red and twice as large as the others.
"Silana Redwings,"
Raist muttered, eyes narrowing.
"Elderborn and true-blooded Tyam, you lead, Soul-Taken, whose blood is alien to this world. I feel you all."
He raised fists to the sky.
"Colder than the ice-born of Jaghut hands, as dark as blindness. I feel you."
He lowered his arms.
"Harass me not, Elainter. I cannot enslave you, but I will destroy you. Know that. I will drive you to the ground, each and all, and with my own hands I shall tear your hearts from your chests."
His eyes narrowed on the four black dragons.
"Soul-Taken, you would challenge me at the command of another. You would battle with me for no reason of your own. Ah, but if I were to command you, I would not throw your lives away so carelessly. I would cherish you, Soul-Taken. I would give you causes worth believing in, show you the true rewards of power."
Raist scowled as the derision swept through his mind.
"So be it."
The dragons passed low overhead in silence, banking once again and disappearing behind the hills to the south. Raist spread his arms wide and unleashed his warren. His flesh split as power flowed into him. His arms shed skin like ash. He both felt and heard hills crack all around him, the snapping of stone, the sundering of crags. To all sides the horizon blurred as dust curtained skyward. He faced south.
"This is my power. Come to me."
A long minute passed. He frowned at the hills before him, then cried out and whirled to his right, just as Silana and the four black dragons, all less than 10 feet above the ground, plunged over the summit of the hill he had been climbing. Raist screamed at the whirlwind of power battering him, his shrunken eyes locked on Silana's blank, empty, deadly gaze, eyes as large as the Jaghut's head, as it bore down upon him with the speed of a springing viper. The red dragon's jaws opened wide, and Raist found himself staring down the beast's throat. He screamed a second time and released his power all at once. The air detonated as the warrens collided. Jagged shards of rock ripped in all directions. Starvald Demelain and Kurald Gelain warred with Omtos Felak in a savage maelstrom of will. Grasses, earth, and rock withered to fine ash on all sides, and within the vortex stood Raist, his power roaring from him. Lashes of sorcery from the dragons lanced into his body, boring through his withered flesh. The Jagat tyrant flayed his power like a scythe. Blood splattered the ground, sprayed in gouts. The dragons shrieked. A wave of incandescent fire struck Raist from the right, solid as a battering fist. Howling, he was thrown through the air, landing in a bank of powdery ash. Sylana's fire raced over him, blackening what was left of his flesh. The tyrant clambered upright, his body jerking uncontrollably, as sorcery gouted from his right hand. The ground shook as Raist's power hammered Sylana down, driving the dragon skidding and tumbling across the slope. The tyrant's exultant roar was cut short as talons the length of a forearm crunched into him from behind. A second clawed foot joined the first, snapping through the bones of Raist's chest as if they were twigs. More talons flexed around him as a second dragon sought grip. The tyrant twisted helplessly as the claws lifted him into the air and started ripping his body apart. He dislocated his own shoulder in reaching round to dig his fingers into a sleek, scaled shin. At the contact, Omto's Felak surged into the dragon's leg, shattering bone, boiling blood. Raist laughed as the claws spasmed loose and he was flung away. More bones snapped as he struck the ground. But it did not matter. His power was absolute. The vessel that carried it had little relevance. If need be, the tyrant would find other bodies, bodies in the thousands. He climbed once more to his feet. "Now," he whispered, "I deliver death." Chapter 21. The flowering of light from darkness brought into my sight there on the field a host of dragons caught like a crest of wind before the eternal flame. I saw the ages in their eyes, a worldly map inscribed in each world scale on their hides. Their sorcery bled from them like the breathing of stars, and I knew then that dragons had come among us. Anomandaris, Fisher, birthdate unknown. Shadows crowded the garden's undergrowth. Adjunct Lorn rose from her crouch and brushed the dirt from her hands. "Find an acorn," she smiled to herself. "Plant it." Somewhere beyond the heavily wooded garden, servants shouted at each other as they scrambled about making last-minute arrangements. She hitched her cloak's tail into her belt and quietly slipped among the boles of vine-wrapped trees. A moment later, the back wall came into view. An alley lay beyond, narrow and choked with the leaves and fallen branches from the gardens rising above the walls on its either side. Her route in, and now out, was a thing of ease. She scaled the rough stoned wall, grasping vines when necessary, then slid over the top. She landed with a soft crunch of twigs and dry leaves, within shadows as deep as those in the garden. She adjusted her cloak, then walked to one end of the alley, where she leaned against a corner, crossed her arms, and smiled at the crowds passing to and fro on the street before her. Two tasks left to perform, then she would leave this city. One of those tasks, however, might prove impossible. She sensed nothing of Sori's presence. Perhaps the woman was indeed dead. Under the circumstances, it was the only explanation. She watched the sea of people, its tide of faces swirling past. The latent madness there made her uneasy, especially with the city's guards maintaining an aloof distance. She wondered at the taint of terror in that multitude of faces, and how almost every face seemed familiar. Darujistan blurred in her mind, becoming 100 other cities, each rising out of her past as if on parade. Joy and fear, agony and laughter, The expressions merged into one, the sounds coming to her no different from each other. She could distinguish nothing, the faces becoming expressionless, the sounds a roar of history, without meaning. Lorne passed a hand over her eyes, then staggered back a step and reeled into the alley's shadows behind her. She slid down one wall into a sagging crouch.
A celebration of insignificance. Is that all we are in the end? Listen to them.
In a few hours, the city's intersections would explode. Hundreds would die instantly, thousands to follow. Amid the rubble of shattered cobbles and toppled buildings would be these faces, locked-in expressions, somewhere between joy and terror. And from the dying would come sounds, hopeless cries that dwindled in the passing of pain. She had seen them all before, those faces. She knew them all, knew the sound of their voices, sounds mired in human emotions, sounds clear and pure with thought, and sounds wavering in that chasm between the two. Is this, she wondered, my legacy?
And one day, I'll be just one more of those faces, frozen in death and wonder.
Lorne shook her head, but it was a one effort. She realized with sudden comprehension that she was breaking down. The adjunct was cracking, its armor crumbling, and the luster gone from its marbled grandeur. A title as meaningless as the woman bearing it. The Empress. Just another face she had seen somewhere before, a mask behind which someone hid from mortality.
No use hiding,
she whispered, frowning down at the dead leaves and branches around her.
No use.
A few minutes later, she pushed herself upright once again. She brushed the dirt meticulously from her cloak. One task remained within her abilities. Find the coin bearer. Kill him, and take Opon's coin. Make the god pay for its intrusion in Empire affairs. The Empress and Taishrin would see to that. The task demanded concentration, fixing her senses upon one particular signature. It would be her last act, she knew. But she would succeed. Death at the hands of failure was unthinkable. Lorne turned to the street. Dusk crept from the ground and engulfed the crowds. Far off to the east, thunder sounded, yet the air was dry with no hint of rain. She checked her weapons.
The adjunct's mission, she said quietly, is almost done.
She entered the street and disappeared into the mob. Cropper rose from his table at the Phoenix Inn and attempted to fasten the last button on his waistcoat. Failing, he let his stomach relax once again and let loose a weary sigh. Well, at least the coat had been cleaned. He adjusted the cuffs of his new shirt, then walked out of the mostly empty bar. He'd spent the last hour seated at his table, to all outward appearances, musing on nothing of great importance, though in his head a pattern formed, born of his talent, and it disturbed him greatly. Mies and Arilta, losing Crocus and the girl, brought everything into focus. As with most unwitting servants of the gods, once the game was done, so was the servant's life. The coin might be gambled in a single contest, but to have it floating around indefinitely was far too dangerous. No, Crocus would find his luck abandoning him when he needed it most, and it would cost the lad his life.
No, no, Cropper had murmured over his tankard. Cropper can't permit that.
Yet the pattern of success remained elusive. He felt certain he had covered all the potential threats regarding the lad, or rather, someone was doing a good job of protecting Crocus. That much the pattern showed him. He experienced a nagging suspicion that the someone wasn't himself, or any of his agents. And he'd just have to trust in its integrity. Circlebreaker had come through yet again, and Cropper was still confident that Turbinor's hunt for the man would prove fruitless.
The eel knew how to protect his own. In fact, Circle Breaker was due for retirement, for the man's own safety, and Cropper intended to deliver the good news this very night at Lady Simtar's fate. Circle Breaker deserved no less after all these years. The pattern also told him something he already knew. His cover was blown. The spell he had cast on Marilia wouldn't last much longer, nor was it required to. Cropper had wanted his freedom unimpeded this day. After that, well, things would fall as they would fall, and the same applied for his meeting with Baruch. If anything gave Cropper pause, it was the pattern's abrupt ending. Beyond tonight, the future was blank. Clearly, a crux had been reached, and it would turn, he knew, at Lady Simtar's fate. Cropper now entered the Higher Estates district, with a generous nod at the lone guard stationed near the ramp. The man scowled, but otherwise made no comment. The fate was set to begin in 30 minutes, and Cropper planned on being one of the first to arrive. His mouth watered at the thought of all those pastries, fresh and dripping with warm, sweet liquids. He removed his mask from inside his coat and smiled at it. Perhaps, among all those attending, High Alchemist Baruch alone would appreciate the irony of this molded visage.
"Ah, well," he sighed. "One is more than enough, given who that one is. After all, is Cropper greedy?"
His stomach rumbled in answer. Crocus strained his eyes toward the darkening east. Something like lightning flashed every now and then beyond the hills, each one closer than the last. But the thunder's rumble, which had begun early that afternoon and still continued, sounded somehow wrong. Its timber unlike the normal bass that rolled through the earth. It seemed almost brittle. The clouds that had appeared over the hill earlier had been an eerie ochre color, sickly, and those clouds now approached the city.
"When are we leaving?"
Absalar asked, leaning on the wall beside him. Crocus shook himself. "Now, it's dark enough."
"Crocus, what will you do if Shalice Dahl betrays you a second time?"
He could barely see her face in the gloom. Had she meant that to cut? It was hard to tell from her voice.
"She won't," he said, telling himself that he believed it. "Trust me."
And he turned toward the stairwell.
"I do,"
she said simply.
Crocus winced. Why did she make things seem so easy for her? Hood's Breath, he wouldn't trust him. Of course, he didn't know Shalice very well. They'd only had that one confusing conversation. What if she called the guards? Well, he'd make sure Absalar got away safely. He paused and grasped her arm.
"Listen." His own voice sounded unduly harsh, but he pushed on. "If something goes wrong, go to the Phoenix Inn. Right? Find Mies, Irilta, or my friends Cropper and Murillo. Tell them what happened."
"All right, Crocus."
"Good." He released her arm.
"Wish we had a lantern," he said, as he stepped into the darkness, one hand reaching before him.
"Why?"
Absalar asked, slipping past him. She took his hand and led him down.
"I can see. Don't let go of my hand."
That might be a hard thing to do, even if he had desired it, he realized. Still, there were a lot of rough calluses on that small hand. He let them remind him of what this woman was capable of doing, though the effort embarrassed him in some vague way. Eyes wide yet seeing nothing, Crocus allowed himself to be guided down the stairs. The captain of Simtar's house guard viewed Whiskey Jack and his men with obvious distaste.
"I thought you were all bargassed."
He stepped up to Trotz and jabbed a finger into the warrior's massive chest.
"You led me to believe you were all like you, Niganga."
A low, menacing growl emerged from Trotz, and the captain stepped back, one hand reaching for his short sword.
"Captain," Whiskey Jack said, "if we were all bargassed."
The man's narrow face swung to him with a scowl.
you'd never be able to afford us.
The sergeant finished with a tight smile. He glanced at Trotz.
Niganga? Hood's breath, he thought.
Niganga is my second in command, Captain. Now, how would you like us positioned? Just beyond the fountain, he said. Your backs will be to the garden, which has run wild of late. We don't want any guests getting lost in there, so you gently steer them back. Understood? And when I say gently, I mean it. You're to salute anyone who talks to you, and if there's an argument, direct them to me, Captain Stillis. I'll be making the rounds, but anyone of the house guard can find me.
Whiskey Jack nodded.
Understood, sir.
He turned to survey his squad. Fiddler and Hedge stood behind Trotz, both looking eager. Past them, Mallet and Quickben stood on the edge of the street, heads bent together in conversation. The sergeant frowned at them, noticing how his wizard winced with every boom of thunder to the east. Captain Stillis marched off after giving them directions through the estate's rooms, out to the terrace and garden beyond. Whiskey Jack waited for the man to leave his line of sight. Then he strode to Quick Ben and Mallet.
What's wrong? He asked.
Quick Ben looked frightened. Mallet said,
That thunder and lightning, Sergeant. Well, it ain't no storm. Parent's story is looking real.
Meaning we have little time, Whiskey Jack said. Wonder why the adjunct didn't show up. You think she's melting her boots, getting away from here?
Mallet shrugged.
Don't you get it?
Quick Ben said shakily. He took a couple of deep breaths, then continued.
That creature out there is in a fight. We're talking major sorceries, only it's getting closer, which means that it's winning. And that means...
We're in trouble, Whiskey Jack finished. All right. We go as planned for now. Come on. We've been assigned right where we want to be. Quick Ben, you sure Kalam and Paran can find us? The wizard moaned.
Directions delivered, Sergeant.
Good. Let's move then. Through the house and eyes forward.
He looks like he's going to sleep for days,
Kalam said, straightening beside Cole's bed and facing the captain. Paran rubbed his red-shot eyes. She must have given them something, he insisted wearily, even if they didn't see it. Kalam wagged his head.
I've told you, sir, she didn't. Everyone was on the lookout for something like that. The squad's still clean. Now, we'd better get moving.
Paran climbed to his feet with an effort. He was exhausted, and he knew he was just an added burden. She'll turn up at this estate, then, he insisted, strapping on his sword.
Well, Kalam said as he walked to the door, that's where you and me come in, right? She shows up and we take her out, just like you wanted to do all along.
Right now, Paran said, joining the assassin, the shape I'm in will make my role in the fight a short one. Consider me the surprise factor, the one thing she won't be expecting, the one thing that'll stop her for a second.
He looked into the man's dark eyes. Make that second count, Corporal. Kalam grinned.
I hear you, sir.
They left Cole still snoring contentedly and went down to the bar's main floor. As they passed along the counter, Skurve looked at them warily. Kalam released an exasperated curse and in a surge of motion reached out and grasped him by the shirt. He pulled the squealing innkeeper halfway across the counter until their faces were inches apart.
I'm sick of waiting,
the assassin growled.
You get this message to this city's master of the assassins. I don't care how. Just do it, and do it fast. Here's the message. The biggest contract offer of the master's life will be waiting at the back wall of Lady Simtal's estate. Tonight. If the guildmaster's worthy of that name, then maybe, just maybe... It's not too big for the guild to handle. Deliver that message, even if you have to shout it from the rooftops, or I'm coming back here with killing in mind.
Paran stared at his corporal, too tired to be amazed.
We're wasting time,
he drawled. Kalam tightened his grip and glared into Skurv's eyes.
We'd better not be, he growled.
He released the man by gently lowering him onto the countertop. Then he tossed a handful of silver coins beside Skurv.
For your troubles, he said.
Paran gestured and the assassin nodded. They left the Phoenix Inn. Still following orders, Corporal? Kalam grunted.
We were instructed to make the offer in the name of the Empress, Captain. If the contract's accepted and the assassinations are done, then Lassine will have to pay up, whether we've been outlawed or not.
A gutted city for Dujek and his army to occupy, with the Empress paying for it.
She'll choke on that, Kalam.
He grinned.
That's her problem. Not mine.
In the street, the grey faces moved through the noisy crowd like silent spectres, lighting the gas lamps with long-poled sparkers. Some people, brazen with drink, hugged the figures and blessed them. The grey faces, hooded and anonymous, simply bowed in reply and continued on their way once freed. Kalam stared at them, his brows knitting.
Something the matter, Corporal?
Paran asked.
Just something nagging me. Can't pin it down. Only it's got to do with those grey faces.
The captain shrugged. They keep the lanterns lit.
Shall we make our way, then?
Kalam sighed.
Might as well, sir.
The black lacquered carriage, drawn by two dun stallions, moved slowly through the press. A dozen feet ahead marched a brace of Baruch's own houseguards, driving a wedge down the street center, using their wrapped weapons when shouts and curses failed. In the plush confines of the carriage, the outside roar surged and ebbed like a distant tide, muted by the alchemist's sound-deadening spells. He sat with his chin lowered on his chest, his eyes, hidden in the shadow of his brow and half-shut, studying the Tista Andi seated across from him. Rake had said nothing since his return to the estate, just minutes before their planned departure. Baruch's head throbbed. Sorcery shook the hills to the east, sending waves of concussion that struck every mage within range like mailed fists. He well knew its source. The Barrow Dweller approached, its every step contested by Anamanda Rake's Tista Andi. It seemed that Mammoth's prediction had been too generous. They didn't have days. They had hours. Yet despite the warring warrens, despite the fact that the Jaikark tyrant's power was superior to Rake's mages, that the Barrow Dweller came on, relentless, unstoppable, a growing storm of Omtos Felak sorcery, the Lord of Moonspawn sat at ease on the padded couch, legs stretched out before him and gloved hands folded in his lap. The mask lying on the velvet at his side was exquisite, if ghastly. In better times, Baruch might have been amused, appreciative of its workmanship, but right now when he regarded it, his lone response was suspicion. A secret was locked in that mask, something that bespoke the man who would wear it. But the secret eluded Baruch. Turban Orr adjusted his hawk mask and paused just before the wide steps leading to the estate's main doors. He heard another carriage arrive at the gates and turned. From the doorway at his back came the shuffle of footsteps. Lady Simtal spoke behind him.
I would rather you'd permitted one of my servants to inform me of your arrival, Councilman. Allow me the privilege of escorting you into the main chamber.
She slipped her arm through his.
A moment,
he muttered, eyes on the figure now emerging from the carriage.
It's the alchemist carriage, he said. But that's hardly Baruch now, is it?
Lady Simtal looked.
Drake unleashed, she gasped. Who would that be? Baruch's guest, Orr said dryly.
Her grip bit into his arm.
I'm aware of his privilege, Councilman. Tell me, have you seen this one before?
The man shrugged. His mast. How could I tell?
How many men do you know, Turban, who are 7 feet tall and wear two-handed swords strapped to their backs?
She squinted.
That white hair. Do you think it's part of the mask?
The councilman did not reply. He watched as Baruch emerged behind the stranger. The alchemist's mask was a conservative silver-inlaid half-shield that no more than covered his eyes. An obvious statement denying duplicity. Turbanor grunted, knowing well that his suspicions about the alchemist's influence and power were accurate. His eyes returned to the stranger. His mask was that of a black dragon, lacquered with fine silver-traced highlights. Somehow, the dragon's expression seemed sly.
Well, Lady Simtal demanded, are we going to linger out here all night? And where's your dear wife, anyway?
Ill, he said distractedly. He smiled at her. Shall we introduce ourselves to the alchemist's guest? And have I complimented you yet on your attire?
You haven't,
she said. A black panther suits you, lady.
But of course it does,
she replied testily, as Baruch and his guest strode down the paved walk toward them. She disengaged her arm and stepped forward.
Good evening, alchemist Baruch. Welcome,
she added to the black dragon masked man.
An astonishing presentation. Have we met?
Good evening, Lady Simtal, Baruch said, bowing. Councilman Turbanor. Permit me to introduce.
He hesitated, but the Tista Andi had been firm on this.
Lord Anomander Rake, a visitor to Darujistan. The alchemist waited to see if the councilman would recognize the name.
Turbanor bowed formally.
On behalf of the City Council, welcome, Lord Anomander Rake.
Baruch sighed. Anomander Rake, a name known by poets and scholars, but not, it appeared, by councilmen. Orr continued,
as a lord, I assume you hold title to land?
He almost stepped back as the dragon's visage swung to regard him, deep blue eyes fixed on his.
Land? Yes, councilman, I hold title. However, my title is honorary, presented to me by my people.
Rake looked past Orr's shoulder to the room beyond the wide doorway.
It seems, lady, that the evening is well underway.
Indeed, she laughed.
Come, join in the festivities.
Baruch breathed another relieved sigh. Murillo had to admit that Cropper's choice of mask suited him perfectly. He found himself grinning behind his feather-decked peacock mask, in spite of his trepidation. He stood near the opened doorway, leading out to the patio and garden, a goblet of light wine in one hand, the other hitched in his belt. Raleigh leaned against the wall beside him, arms crossed. His mask was that of a Catlin tiger, idealized to mimic the god Trake's image. Murillo knew the assassin let the wall bear his weight out of exhaustion, rather than from a lazy slouch. He wondered yet again if matters would fall to him. The assassin stiffened suddenly, eyes on the entrance across from them. Murillo craned as he passed the crowd. There, the hawk. He murmured,
that's Turbanor, all right. Who's he with?
Simtal,
Raleigh growled.
And Baruch. And some monster of a man wearing a dragon's mask. And armed.
Baruch, Murillo laughed nervously. Let's hope he doesn't recognize us. It wouldn't take him a second to put everything together.
It doesn't matter, Raleigh said. He won't stop us.
Maybe you're right.
Then Murillo almost dropped his glass.
Hood's weary feet.
Raleigh hissed between his teeth.
Damn it. Look at him. He's heading straight for them.
Lady Simtal and Turban Orr excused themselves, leaving Baruch and Rake momentarily alone in the middle of the chamber. People moved around them, some nodding deferentially at Baruch, but all keeping their distance. A crowd gathered around Simtal, where she stood at the foot of the winding staircase, eager with questions regarding Anamanda Rake. A figure approached Baruch and his companion. Short, round, wearing a faded red waistcoat, both hands clutching pastries, the man wore a cherub's mask, its open red-lipped mouth smeared with cake icing and crumbs. His route to them met with one obstacle after another as he negotiated his way across the room, excusing himself at every turn and twist. Rake noticed the newcomer, for he said,
"Seems eager, doesn't he?"
Baruch chuckled.
"He's worked for me," he said, "and I've worked for him as well. Anamanda Rake, behold the one they call the Eel, Darujistan's master spy."
"Do you jest?"
"No."
Cropper arrived, his chest heaving.
"Master Baruch," he said breathlessly, "what a surprise to find you here."
The cherub face swung over and up to Rake.
"The hair is an exquisite touch, sir. Exquisite. I am named Cropper, sir. Cropper the First."
He raised a pastry to his mouth and jammed it in.
"This is Lord Anamanda Rake, Cropper."
Cropper nodded vigorously, then swallowed audibly.
"Of course. Why then? You must be quite used to such a lofty stance, sir. Cropper envies those who can look down upon everyone else."
"It is easy to fool oneself," Rake answered, "interviewing those beneath one as small and insignificant. The risks of oversight, you might say."
"Cropper might well say, assuming the pun was intended. But who would disagree that the dragon's lot is ever beyond the ken of mere humankind? Cropper can only guess at the thrill of flight, the wail of high winds, the rabbits scurrying below as one's shadows brushes their limited awareness."
"My dear Cropper," Baruch sighed, "it is but a mask."
"Such is the irony of life,"
Cropper proclaimed, raising one pastry-filled hand over his head,
"that one learns to distrust the obvious, surrendering instead to insidious suspicion and confused conclusion. But lo, is Cropper deceived? Can an eel swim? Hurrah! These seeming muddy waters are home to Cropper, and his eyes are wide with wonder."
He bowed with a flourish, spattering bits of cake over Rake and Baruch, then marched off, still talking.
"A survey of the kitchen is in order, Cropper suspects."
"An eel, indeed," Rake said in an amused tone. "He is a lesson to us all, is he not?"
"Agreed," Baruch muttered, shoulders slumping. "I need a drink. Let me get you one. Excuse me."
Turban Orr stood with his back to the wall and surveyed the crowded room. He was finding it difficult to relax. The last week had been exhausting. He still awaited confirmation from the Assassin's Guild that Cole was dead. It wasn't like them to take so long to complete a contract, and sticking a knife into a drunk shouldn't have been too difficult. His hunt for the spy in his organizations had reached a dead end, but he remained convinced that such a man, or woman, existed. Again and again, and especially since Lim's assassination, he had found his moves in the council blocked by countermoves, too unfocused for him to point a finger at any one person. But the proclamation was dead in the water. He had come to that conclusion this morning, and he had acted. Even now, his most trusted and capable messenger rode the trader's track, probably passing through the Gadrobi Hills and the thunderstorm at this very moment on his way to Pale. To the Empire. Turban Orr knew the Malazans were on the way. No one in Darujistan could stop them,
and the moon's lord had been defeated once, at Pale. Why would it be any different this time around? No, the time had come to ensure that his own position would survive the Empire's occupation. Or, better yet, an even higher rank to reward his vital support. His eyes fell casually on a guard stationed to one side of the spiral staircase. The man looked familiar somehow. Not his face, but the way he stood, the set of his shoulders. Was the man's usual station at Majesty Hall? No. The uniform was that of a regular, while Majesty Hall was the domain of the elites. Turbinor's frown deepened behind the hawk mask. Then the guard adjusted his helmet strap, and Turbinor gasped. He leaned back against the wall, overcome by trembling.
Despot Barbican! All those nights, night after night for years, that guard had witnessed his midnight meetings with his allies and agents. There stood his spy.
He straightened, closing one hand over the pommel of his dueling sword. He'd leave no room for questions, and damn Simtal's sensibilities, and damn this party. He wanted his vengeance to be swift and immediate. He'd let no one stop him. His eyes fixing on the unsuspecting guard, Turbinor stepped forward. He collided with a hard shoulder and staggered back. A large man in a tiger mask turned to him. Orr waited for an apology, but received only silence. He moved to step past the man. The stranger's arm intercepted him. Turbinor cursed as a gloved hand poured wine down his chest.
"Idiot!" he snapped. "I am Councilman Turbinor! Out of my way!"
"I know who you are," the man said quietly. Orr jabbed a finger into the man's chest.
"Keep that mask on so I'll know who to look for later."
"I didn't even notice your mask,"
the man said, his voice cold and flat.
"Fooled by the nose, I suppose."
The councilman's eyes narrowed.
"Eager to die, are you?"
he grated.
"I will oblige you."
His hand twitched on his sword's pommel.
"In a few minutes. Right now, I have..."
"I wait on no man," Ralek Nom said.
"And certainly not for some thin-lipped prancer pretending to manhood. If you've the belly for a duel, make it now, or stop wasting time with all this talk."
Shaking, Turbinor took a step back and faced the man directly.
"What's your name?"
he demanded hoarsely.
"You are not fit to hear it, Councilman."
Turbinor raised his hands and whirled to the crowd.
"Hear me, guests! Unexpected entertainment for you all!"
Conversation died and everyone faced the councilman. He continued.
"A fool has challenged my honor, friends, and since when has Turbinor permitted such an insult?"
"A duel!"
someone cried excitedly. Voices rose. Orr pointed at Ralek Nom.
"This man, so bold as to wear Trake's face, will be dead shortly. Look upon him now, friends, as he looks upon you, and know that he is all but dead already."
"Stop babbling," Ralek drawled.
The councilman pulled the mask from his face, revealing a tight grin.
"If I could kill you 1,000 times, he said, "it would not be enough to satisfy me. I must settle with you but once."
Ralek removed his mask and tossed it onto the carpeted stairs. He looked upon Turbinor with flat, dark eyes.
"Done breaking wind, Councilman."
"Unmasked and still a stranger," Orr said, scowling. "So be it. Find yourself a second."
A thought struck him, and he turned back to the crowd, searching it. Toward the back, he saw the mask he sought, that of a wolf. His choosing of a second could well have political benefits, assuming the man accepted. And in this crowd, he'd be a fool to deny Orr.
For myself, he said loudly, I would be honored if Councilman Estrasian Dahl act as my second.
The wolf started. Beside him stood two women, one no more than a girl. Dahl's wife was dressed as a veiled woman of Callows, while the girl had selected, outrageously, the minimal garb of a Barghast war maiden. Both wife and daughter spoke to Estrasian. He stepped forward.
The honor is mine,
he rumbled, completing the ritual acceptance. Turbinor felt a surge of triumph. To have his most powerful enemy in the council at his side for this duel would send a message mixed enough to panic half the council members present. Pleased at his coup, he faced his nameless opponent again.
And your second?
Silence fell over the room.
I haven't much time,
Lady Simtal said in a low voice.
After all, as the hostess for this fete, it's your duty, murmured the man before her, to satisfy your guests.
He reached forth and brushed the hair from her forehead.
Which is something I'm certain you can do, and do well.
She smiled and walked to the door. She locked its latch, then spun to face the man again.
Perhaps half an hour, she said.
The man strode to the bed and tossed down his leather gloves.
I'm confident, he said, that those 30 minutes will be satisfying indeed, each more than the last.
Lady Simtal joined him beside the bed.
I suppose,
she whispered, as she slipped her arms around the man's neck and drew his face down to her lips,
that you've no choice now but to tell the Widow Lim the sad news.
She touched her lips to his, then ran her tongue along the line of his jaw.
What sad news is that? Oh, that you found yourself a more worthy lover, of course.
Her tongue reached into his ear. Abruptly, she pulled back and met his eyes searchingly.
Do you hear that?
She asked. He brought his arms around her and drew her closer.
Hear what? That's just it, she said. It's suddenly quiet downstairs. I'd better... They're in the garden, no doubt,
the man said reassuringly.
The minutes are passing, lady.
She hesitated, then made the mistake of letting him press his body against hers. Lady Simtal's eyes widened in near alarm. Her breathing changed.
So, she gasped, what are we doing still dressed? Good question,
Marilio growled, pulling both of them onto the bed. In the silence following Turbinor's question, Baruch found himself preparing to step forward. Knowing well what that would reveal, he felt compelled, nevertheless. Ralik Nom was here to right a dreadful wrong. More, the man was a friend, closer to the alchemist than Crupper or Marilio, and in spite of his profession, a man of integrity. And Turbinor was Lady Simtal's last link to real power. If Ralik killed the man, she'd fall. Kol's return to the council was something Baruch and his fellow Torud mages greatly desired. And Turbinor's death would be a relief. More was riding on this duel than Ralik imagined. The alchemist adjusted his robe and drew a deep breath. A large hand closed on his upper arm, and before Baruch could react, Lord Anomander Rick stepped forward.
I offer my services as second, he said loudly.
He met Ralik's eyes. The assassin betrayed nothing, not once looking at Baruch. He answered Rake's offer with a nod.
Perhaps, Turbinor sneered, the two strangers know each other.
We've never met, Rake said. However, I find myself instinctively sharing his distaste for your endless talk, Councilman. Thus I seek to avoid a council debate on who will be this man's second. Shall we proceed?
Turbinor led the way out to the terrace, Astrazian Dahl behind him. As Baruch turned to follow, he felt a familiar contact of energies at his side. He swung his head and recoiled.
Good gods, Mammoth! Where did you get that hideous mask?
The old man's eyes held his briefly, then shied away.
An accurate rendition of Jaghat features, I believe, he said softly, though I think the tusks are a little short.
Baruch shook himself.
Have you managed to find your nephew yet?
No, Mammoth replied. I am deeply worried by that.
Well, the alchemist grunted as they walked outside. Let's hope that Opon's luck holds for the lad.
Of course,
Mammoth murmured. Whiskey Jack's eyes widened as a crowd of excited guests poured out from the main chamber and gathered on the terrace. Fiddler scurried to his side.
It's a duel, Sergeant. The guy with the wine stain on his shirt is one of them, a councilman named Orr. Nobody knows who the other man is. He's over there with that big man in the dragon mask.
The sergeant had been leaning, arms crossed, against one of the marble pillars encircling the fountain. But at seeing the tall dragon-masked figure, he came near to toppling into the fountain behind him.
Hood's balls, he cursed. Recognize that long silver hair, Fid?
The saboteur frowned.
Moonspawn, Whiskey Jack breathed. That's the mage, the lord who stood on that portal and battled Tatrin.
He reeled off an impressive list of curses, then added,
And he's not human.
Fiddler groaned.
Tis Andy. The bastards found us. We had it.
Shut up.
Whiskey Jack was recovering from his shock.
Line everybody up the way that Captain Stillis wanted us. Backs to the woods and hands on weapons. Move!
Fiddler scrambled. The sergeant watched the saboteur round up his men.
Where in Hood's name was Kalam and Paran anyway?
He caught Quick Ben's eye and gestured the mage over.
Fid explained it,
Quick Ben said, leaning close.
I may not be much use, Sergeant. That barrow dweller's unleashing waves of nasty stuff. My head feels ready to explode.
He grinned wanly.
And look around. You can pick out all the mages by the sick looks on their faces. If we all accessed our warrens, we'd be fine.
Then why don't you?
The wizard grimaced.
That Jaghat would fix on us as if we were a beacon of fire. And he'd take the weaker ones. Even from this distance he'd take them. And then there'd be Hood to pay.
Whiskey Jack watched the guests create a space on the terrace, lining up on either side.
Check with Hedge and Fiddler, he ordered, eyes lingering on the Tista Andy. Make sure they've got something handy, in case it all comes apart. This estate's got to burn then, hot and long. We'll need the diversion to set off the intersection mines. Give me the nod telling me they're up to it.
Right.
Quick Ben moved off. Whiskey Jack grunted in surprise as a young man stepped round him, dressed as a thief, complete with face mask.
Excuse me,
the man muttered as he walked into the crowd. The sergeant stared after him, then glanced back at the garden.
How had that lad got past them in the first place? He could have sworn they'd sealed off the woods.
He loosened his sword surreptitiously in its sheath. Crocus had no idea what kind of costume Shalice Dahl would be wearing, and he was resigned to a long hunt. He had left Absalar at the garden's back wall, and now felt guilty. Still, she had seemed to take it well, though in a way that made him feel even worse.
Why did she have to be so nice about things?
He spared barely a thought about the crowd's strange formation, looking, as he was, for a head somewhere at chest level to everyone else. As it turned out, that proved unnecessary, for Shalice Dahl's costume was no disguise. Crocus found himself between two burly house guards. Across from him, 20 feet away, with no one to block his view, stood Shalice and an older woman Crocus took to be her mother. Their attention was held unerringly on a tall, severe-looking man standing at one end of the cleared space and speaking.